Our ancestors evolved in warmer areas, but eventually made their way to more inhospitable regions, including frigid parts of the planet. This hour, how our bodies adapt to different climates. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we enter the coldest months of the year, we'll learn how our ancestors developed various physiological traits that enabled survival in extreme climates. My guests, human physiologist Kevin Craigle and anthropologist Robert Franciscus of the University of Iowa. Also, Nathan Holton of the University of Iowa tells us why men's noses are larger than women's. A sniff of this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the coldest, darkest months of the season are just ahead of us. We've now entered December, and it's clear some of us cope better than others with the cold. Well, just take a look around your workplace, for instance. Maybe you know someone, or you yourself love thick, cozy garments from now until, March or so. Someone else in your workplace, or perhaps you like to wear short sleeves all year round. This hour, we want to find out what's behind our ability to adapt to different temperatures as individuals and as a species, and perhaps along the way get some tips on how to cope with the cold. I'd like to have you join our conversation. How do you get used to cold weather? 1-866-780-9100. Do you have a trick? Do you have something you do every time the temperatures start to dip to get yourself used to colder weather? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. My first guest is Kevin Craigle, professor and chair in the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa. Professor Craigle, Kevin, welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
Let's start off with some of the basics. So what is happening to our bodies now at this time of year in Iowa as the temperatures dip?
Well, the human body, interestingly, has a remarkable ability to make adjustments to heat. So our adjustments in terms of heat acclimatization are really impressive. Conversely, when we are exposed to cold, we don't make the same kinds of profound adjustments, really minimal compared to what we do in terms of heat, which is quite interesting. So the primary adjustments humans make in encountering cold, they're twofold. One is behavioral, clothing, housing, adjustments in terms of exposure of the skin. The second is adjustments in terms of metabolism. We do have mechanisms that allow us to generate heat internally. Mm-hmm. One of those, a simple example, is shivering. And so those are the predominant adjustments that we make with especially an acute exposure to cold temperatures.
Mm-hmm. And so the adaptability to cold weather is most apparent to me when spring rolls around. We would have, say now, a 40-degree day, and people are dressed as they are. And then you have a long, hard winter. And then maybe in March or maybe even February, who knows, with the weather the way it's been, you might have a 40-degree, a sunny day, and you'll see people instantly out with shorts and T-shirts on.
Right.
So is that an indication that we have acclimatized?
There's certainly a portion
of
it.
Or we're just happy.
there is some of it is behavioral and perception based, but there is the ability to make small adjustments to the cold in terms of the first step would be called habituation. Second step would be then acclimatization. So with repeated exposure to cold, there's clear evidence that there are some adjustments that get made. Now, you're having to take into account in terms of different types of populations, children versus older individuals, body types, sex, male versus female, heavier individuals, people with more muscle mass. There is such a range of conditions to take into account. But clearly, over an exposure period, say in the winter, we do make some physiological adjustments.
Okay, I want to talk about those different types in a minute, but tell me what are the adjustments that we make? You mentioned heat. It's easy to think of sweating,
right,
cooling us down. But on the other side of things, how do our bodies change inside to accommodate the cold?
Well, interestingly, some of these adjustments aren't necessarily optimal from a design point of view, but for example, there are data showing that we start shivering at a lower internal body temperature. So on the one hand, that may not make sense. But on the other hand, you look at the response pattern and say, okay, we need to somehow save energy. Yeah. And so we may cope with a lower body core temperature. The other response we typically do whenever we encounter cold weather is start vasoconstricting the skin vasculature. So we reduce blood flow, effectively create an insulating layer in our skin. And what's interesting is with more and more cold exposure, we tend not to vasoconstrict the skin to the same extent. And so the benefit there is that we have increased tactile response, and we have better ability to use our hands and feet, for example. They're not so cold. The payoff or the trade-off there, though, is that then we're getting some of that warm blood from the body core to the skin. So there's this alternating vasoconstriction dilation that helps perfuse the skin of the fingers, especially so that they can function. But some of that warm blood that's in the core that's maintaining core temperature is then going to the skin and gets dissipated. So we seem to be able to operate at a little bit lower core temperature as we cold acclimatize.
So it doesn't make a difference if when September, the first cold days in September or October roll around, if we get that chill in the air and then we say, I could wear a sweater or I could not wear a sweater. If I would consciously choose not to be cozy warm, would I adapt better into the winter months?
The research studies in that kind of area would say yes, you will have some adjustments. Again, they're subtle. They're going to vary from individual to individual, but certainly that would be the right approach.
Okay. What types of people are more tolerant of cold weather than others?
Well, certainly individuals with more insulative abilities, higher percent body fat, you're going to be more insulated. Those people seem to have a better ability to maintain core body temperature. Individuals that are larger with more muscle mass have a better ability to increase metabolic heat, for example, shivering to that extent. On the other end of the spectrum, individuals with a surface area to mass ratio that's greater, more skin surface area compared to their body weight, and typically females would fall into that category versus males, they're going to dissipate heat more easily. So in a cold environment, that's not an advantage. So that's why anecdotally, females tend to have colder hands, colder feet.
Mm-hmm. Are there other ways to build up tolerance to cold temperatures?
Other than the exposure to cold, no.
No. Okay. Nothing to do with diet or anything like that?
No.
Okay. What is the connection between fitness? You touched on it, though, but can we make ourselves fitter, we are more tolerant of cold?
There are studies showing that individuals who are aerobically trained have a better ability to maintain core body temperature and especially cope with colder environments. So if you're trained and are continuing to transition, say, from the fall to the winter with cold temperatures, you're certainly going to cope better. And so the aerobic training portion of it does seem to allow people to do a little better in a cold environment.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that humans over time have become more adaptive to hotter temperatures than colder temperatures. And actually in colder temperatures, we just try to avoid being cold.
Right.
Even Inuits, Laplanders, they make their clothing or their igloos, whatever shelters they have, warm,
relatively
warm to their environment. And yet we have other non-human animals who do live out there, polar bears, for instance, seals. How do they do it?
The different mammalian species certainly have different types of insulative capacities. Blubber, for example, in some of these species that you've mentioned, there are different metabolic components. There are different types of fat tissue in different kinds of species, brown fat versus white fat, and the brown fat in these species allows more heat to be generated. So it's certainly physiologically based in these animals.
Mm-hmm. Each year, over 1,000 deaths in the U.S. are attributed to excessive natural cold. We had a tragedy in southwest Iowa this past weekend.
Right.
Two boys died after falling into through the ice in a farm pond. Why is cold water more dangerous than cold air?
The simple explanation is that cold water can extract so much more heat than cold air. So even in 50, 60 degree water temperature, you can extract a huge amount of heat from the body, core, and the skin. And so it's quite easy to quickly develop hypothermia. And so as you progress through those stages, clearly there's impacting on mental capacity, confusion. As you start trying to swim in that cold environment, you're exposing more of the skin surface, so there's more convective heat loss, kind of analogous to wind chill. So it's really easy to lower core body temperature quite quickly. And at some point, muscle function starts declining significantly as the muscles get colder. So even trying to swim becomes compromised.
Mm-hmm. What is that really horrible feeling that a person may get? And I've had it, for instance, on the last time I can think of, in the winter, I was in a parking lot, just thought I was going to walk 100 yards to the store. It was a very cold, wintry day. I didn't have the appropriate coat on, but I stepped outside of the car, and instantly I felt dread, near panic, because my core was rapidly losing heat. Is that what was going on?
Certainly, the sensory component of the skin feeding into the central nervous system. There's probably impact of breathing in cold air, and perhaps some. There's new studies now looking at what cold air may do in terms of regulating, say, cardiovascular function. So the integrated responses from cold to the brain and then back to the periphery in terms of response pattern, it's pretty sophisticated.
Mm-hmm. It's very similar to when the feeling you have when you're have a fever and
right.
you have the shivers in bed. You get this horrible, horrible, shaking, cold feeling.
Right.
And you can't get warm.
Right, because your thermostat in the brain is saying your body should be at this temperature, and it's not.
Okay. Kevin Craigle is my guest, professor and chair of the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa. We're talking this hour as we enter the coldest, darkest months of the season. Want to find out what's behind our ability to adapt to different temperatures as individuals and as a species, perhaps getting some tips on how to cope with the cold. How do you get used to colder weather? Do you have a certain trick? 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you just have a question about our adaptability to the cold. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Also joining us, along with Kevin Craigle, Robert Franciscus is back on our program, professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Iowa. Welcome back, Bob.
Good to be here, Ben.
Let's talk a little bit about why we are today, based on our human origins. Human origins found in Africa. How much cold weather did our ancestors experience?
Well, for the longest period of our history, not much at all. We are essentially a tropically adapted species. We emerged somewhere between about 6 to 7 million years ago in parts of Africa that were, of course, very warm, some cases dry, in some cases more tropical. And for a very, very long time, we were confined to Africa, leaving perhaps as a species for the first time about 1.8 million years ago. That was Homo erectus. But even then, when Homo erectus colonized major parts of the Old World, it was largely along a tropical and subtropical climate spectrum. And movement into higher latitudes with these increasingly colder, more challenging environments is relatively late indeed. Perhaps the first were the Neanderthals, say around 130,000 years ago, that were living in these climates more or less full time and were experiencing glacial conditions in some cases, and they seem to show some very important morphological adaptations to these cold environments.
So just to talk about what the fossil record shows us about adaptations to the cold as early humans evolved.
Well, it's more than just the fossil record. For example, recent work looking at the genomics of lice, head lice, body lice, and pubic lice has indicated that it's very likely that we lost our fur very early in evolution, probably somewhere around 3 to 4 million years ago. So we became these sort of naked apes very early on. And this naked skin, coupled with a very good ability to sweat, produced an excellent sort of heat balancing mechanism under conditions of arid, dry air. And this probably set the stage for the challenges that had to be met by later hominins, who were also very hairless, naked animals who eventually had to rely on clothing. And the Neanderthals certainly must have had to rely on clothing.
Mm-hmm. So the explanation for why we, most of us, have hair on our heads and under our arms and our pubic areas is what happened? Did we start wearing clothing and then lose the hair, or did
No.
it get lost before?
That's a really good question. It appears that the earliest evidence for clothing is much later, perhaps about 90 to 100,000 years ago. And it, in fact, seems to coincide with humans for the first time living in these much more challenging, colder environments. There's some studies that suggest it could even have been earlier in some of the earlier modern humans. But I would think 90 to 100,000 is about the right time frame.
Well, why would hair stay under our arms, for instance, where it's about the warmest you get on your body, right?
Well, perhaps Kevin knows more about this than me, but there's some suggestions of advertising, perhaps sexual advertising. There's suggestions of pheromones and things like that. But you're right. Of course, those are the only places where hair largely stayed.
Uh-huh. Kevin Craigle, did your human physiology tell you anything about that? Jump in here if you have any thoughts on why we might have hair left in our evolution on the places that seem to need it least.
No, I'm going to pass on that one. I think Bob's right on target there in terms of the pheromone link and some of the attraction nature of it.
Yeah. Okay. Let me throw in one thing about that, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that the hair on top of our heads was largely because we became upright and the concentration of sunlight on our head. So our bodies are not as much affected by that as the top of our head is. And it's possible that we're looking at some kind of protective covering that was maintained on the head. I can't explain the other parts of the body.
You've just joined us. We're talking about what's behind our ability to adapt to different temperatures. Bob Franciscus is with us from the Department of Anthropology at the University of Iowa. Kevin Craigle, he's from the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa. And on our we have a tweet from our listener asking, is it ever too cold to go jogging? Kevin Craigle, can I throw that one your way? You certainly do see people jogging in sub-zero or
right.
sub-freezing,
right.
Perhaps even sub-zero temperatures.
The easy answer is no. And the explanation is that the human body does a really nice job of humidifying the very cold air before it reaches the lungs. So you may sense a burning sensation in the throat, upper airways. And what's going on there is that very cold air is being humidified before it reaches the lungs. And so the ability to humidify, warm that air is beneficial as the air reaches the lungs. The trade-off is you may lose more moisture. You're going to probably dry out that airway passage. But there's no risk typically, even with very cold sub-zero temperatures, of damaging the lungs.
But you do want to, and the advice is to breathe through your nose. So you have that passage to warm it up and moisten it.
Nose and mouth. And some people do wear a mask, and that helps with humidification, maintain that moisture in the throat area.
So it doesn't matter if it's nose or mouth. I'd heard that it was better in colder temperatures to breathe through your nose as much as possible.
As much as possible, right.
Okay. let's go back to you, Bob Franciscus. What other adaptations have early humans – do we see in the fossil record or otherwise to colder temperatures?
Well, actually, what we were just talking about, the nasal complex, is one of the best examples. I imagine we're going to be talking about that quite a bit later on.
So yes, we will.
Let me discuss some other ones. We follow a pattern that most mammals follow and even non-mammal organisms. These rules are Bergman's and Allen's rules, and they have to do with the way in which body mass and relative skin surface area is distributed along temperature gradients. So the average changes that you see in colder environments at higher latitude is that within species, the larger organisms tend to be found in the higher latitudes in the polar regions, and that simply has to do with the geometric property of being larger, having a larger body core relative to skin surface area, and thus retaining important heat. And you have just the opposite, of course, in equatorial regions. Humans there follow a sort of pattern of linearity, tall, thin, and therefore they have more skin surface area relative to their body mass. That's Bergman's rule. Allen's rule accompanies that by showing us that in higher latitudes, organisms have shorter limbs. That is to say the forearms and the distal part of the legs tend to be shorter relative to the other parts of the arm and leg. And this has been thought largely to be a function of, again, allowing blood circulation to not have to go as far in colder regions, perhaps inhibiting frostbite on fingers and toes. And interestingly enough, we have these cave paintings that show up around 30,000 to 15,000 years ago. They're not paintings per se. Along with the cave paintings, you have these silhouettes of human hands where various colors have been blown through the mouth onto the hand as it's placed on a cave wall. In many cases, those hands are missing the ends of their digits, and there's all kinds of speculation about are these digits being removed purposefully and what have you. But actually the pattern of the damage to these digits in the little digit and fingers away from the thumb, and Kevin, correct me here if I'm wrong, is consistent with frostbite patterns. The thumb rarely gets frostbite on it compared to some of the smaller digits. Mm-hmm. And we may be looking actually at the outcomes of frostbite in these populations, which, by the way, at this time would have been living in extremely cold environments.
How do we know that they didn't just grow that way,
shorter,
without a joint?
Well, we know because not all of the hands show that. So many of the hands are normal and don't have a problem, presumably because they never experienced the frostbite. Even if these digits were removed, it's thought that possibly they might have been removed as a consequence of frostbite to inhibit any further damage or just to get rid of the tissue that was no longer good.
Oh, that's fascinating. Bob Franciscus is with us, professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Iowa, along with Kevin Craigle, professor and chair of the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa. And they'll be with us. Hope you can both stay around for the next half hour. That would be great. When we come back, we're also going to talk with Nathan Holton. Maybe you heard of this new study, a study that he was the lead author in this new paper. It tells us why men's noses are larger than women's. And we'll talk about our nose's role in dealing with colder weather and variable climates when we come back. If you have questions or comments, 1-866-780-9100. How do you get used to the cold? River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. More River to River after a short break. Glad you could cozy up to our conversation this hour on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're looking at what's behind our ability to adapt to different temperatures as individuals and as a species as we enter the coldest, darkest months of the season. You're welcome to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk, find us on Facebook, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We have with us Bob Franciscus, a professor in the Department of Anthropology, talking about what the fossil record and other things about early humans say about our adaptability to extreme weather. Also with us, Kevin Craigle, professor and chair in the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa. We have a question from our emailer, Sarah. This one to you, Kevin Craigle. Does where you grow up permanently affect your tolerance for cold or heat? Sarah says, I grew up in northern Michigan and moved to South Carolina several years ago. I never could get used to the heat and was glad to have the opportunity to move to Iowa. Well, Sarah, we're glad you're here in Iowa, for one thing. Kevin, what's your comment on that? If you grow up somewhere, are you less adaptable to a different climate somewhere else?
Boy, that's a good question. And I've heard that question, and I've heard anecdotally people speculate that that's the case. I'm not aware of any scientific studies to support that contention. And it's interesting, physiologically, a lot of studies on heat acclimatization, cold acclimatization, altitude acclimatization, and the typical thread there is that it's use it or lose it. From the point of view, I can become heat acclimatized. I then am removed from that environment. I lose that acclimatization fairly quickly, the same with cold. So whether there are predisposed physiological adjustments, I'm not aware of any. There's probably some behavioral components to it that probably are likely explanations in most scenarios.
An email from Ben. Ben says he likes to go to big box stores like Home Depot or Lowe's just to stand in the lighting aisle. So many lights on display that's bright and warm, and you can feel your mood improving as you stand there. cheapest therapy, he says, for the seasonal blahs, and it's free. This is in response to the question of how you get used to or how you cope with our weather. Ben, thank you for that email, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Well, let's focus in on one part of our anatomy for most of the rest of the hour. Human noses, we all know, come in all different shapes and sizes. One feature seems to hold true, though. Men's noses are bigger than women's. And that's according to a new study from the University of Iowa. It concludes that men's noses are about 10% larger than female noses on average, and this is in populations of European descent. Joining us now, Nathan Holton, assistant professor in the University of Iowa College of Dentistry, also lead author of a paper published on this in the American Journal of Physical Anthropology. Nathan Holton, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Talk a little bit about what exactly you found out. On average, human male noses 10% larger than human female noses, but this isn't from birth or an early age. What happens during our growth and development?
Well, what we found in the study, what we were really trying to answer is to what degree might male-female differences in body mass and energetics play a role in the size of the nose? Men have more lean muscle mass, require more energy and more oxygen to support that mass. So we wanted to know if you need to have more oxygen, does the nose respond to that? And what we found was that early in development, for a given body size, males and females have similar sized noses. But it's really after puberty when we see an increase in lean muscle mass, an increase in caloric intake, an increase in oxygen consumption, that for a given body size, a male will have a disproportionately larger nose, which we think suggests that the nose is responding to this need to increase the amount of oxygen to support those expensive tissues.
Mm-hmm. So does this match up with other previous research in this field? How does it fit in?
Well, what we found was that it actually the pattern of nasal development between males and females mirrors the pattern of development that we see for things like caloric intake, oxygen consumption. The males tend to exhibit a disproportionate increase in these energetically relevant variables after puberty. I mean, there's some difference before puberty, but it's really after puberty that these differences take off. And the nose follows that pattern. So what we found was that nasal development differences in males and females mirror those energetic developmental patterns.
Mm-hmm. Besides being a nice thing to have in the center of our face, what can we tell by looking at someone's nose about them? Can we tell anything about them?
Well, what I would say is that a lot of the differences that we see in the nose are actually inside the nose. So it's not so much just the external part.
Okay.
That's part of it, but really the bulk of the difference is found inside the skull. So the part of the nose that we see when we look at a person's face is really just a small percentage of the actual amount of airspace that's available. And so in that sense, I would say a lot of the nose is we don't see when we look at somebody.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that our nose connected down our throat to our lungs, is that really thought of as a bit separate than our face, other facial features?
Right. What this suggests is that while the nose and the nasal cavity, the internal part of the nose, is located within the skull, it may be more closely developmentally linked with other parts of the body outside of the skull. So that means that nasal development and nasal function may be more closely tied to things like lung development and the overall airway development versus other parts of the skull, which is interesting because when we look at other studies that we've done and other researchers have done, what we tend to find is that the nose varies somewhat independently from the rest of the skull. So it has sort of a unique pattern of development that suggests that it's
– Varies in what ways?
Well, for example, if you look at experimental evidence that has looked at experimentally altering the width of the face, the width of the palate, changes in the palate, the nose, even if you reduce the size of the palate experimentally, the nose doesn't really respond to those changes. The same sort of thing if you look at studies that have assessed artificial cranial deformation, you know, that have an important effect on other parts of the face. The nose isn't really affected by these dynamics, which means that it's kind of doing its own thing during development.
You looked in this study at people of European descent. Can we assume, or are there studies to back up that this is a rule across ethnicities?
Well, while we only focus on European populations, what I would assume that these male-female differences – I mean, we know that these male-female differences in body composition and tissue composition are present across populations. So while we only looked at this dynamic in European populations, these male-female differences should be manifest in different groups as well.
There's no reason to believe why they wouldn't.
Correct.
Why they wouldn't be that. Bob Franciscus is with us. And as you look back at early humans, you mentioned earlier in the program you were going to save noses for this part of the program. You mentioned Neanderthals. So tell us about nose development in human development.
Right. Well, if we take the long picture of human evolution, probably one of the key developments that occurred happened with Homo erectus. Somewhere around 1.8, 2 million, perhaps a little earlier, that involved a realteration of the flat ape-like nose in terms of a projecting nose that you see in the earliest hominins, the Australopiths, to a somewhat more projecting, visibly present external nose in Homo erectus. And we've known for a long time that this is probably tied in some way to the adaptation to a dry, warm environment, savanna-like environment that Homo erectus increasingly utilized. And this has to do with airflow dynamics. It has to do with temperature exchange and moisture savings to some degree. The nose basically acts like a Southwest U.S. swamp cooler, if you will. It's a sort of self-contained system whose efficiency and whose dynamics are largely determined by ambient conditions. So if you are in a very warm and hot, moist environment, you're going to be taking in that warm, moist, hot air. And as Kevin mentioned earlier, you have virtually enough to protect the lungs because that's what's really important is the cilia in the lungs.
So help me out specifically in this case in understanding the evolution here that a person in a colder climate with a longer nose has a somewhat of an advantage.
That's right, because under conditions of very cold, dry air, you have a different kind of dynamic. The air comes into the nose. It's very cold initially and it's very dry initially, but it must be at approximate inner body core temperature by the time it gets to the lungs, and it needs to be about at 95% relative humidity. If it's not, then you can quickly perturb upper respiratory health. And this is where the upper respiratory infections and all these things come in. So as long as your nose – and we've learned that basically the way it works is in cold environments, an optimum human nose is relatively longer from front to back. It's relatively taller from top to bottom internally, and it's relatively narrow. And the reason for this is that it optimizes – the amount of contact, that is the contact of this initially cold air with these warm, moist mucosal surfaces. Interestingly enough, as you breathe that air out, it's now moistened, it's now warm. That environment in the nose is cooled from that initial dynamic. So as you breathe it out, you recondense that moisture and that heat back into the nose. So not only do you help the system on the way in, mm-hmm. but you actually save moisture and heat on the way out. It's an amazing adaptation. Our noses are really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that you've said that, let me see if there are any chinks in the armor, because I have three people at the table here who are all, to one degree or another, really interested in noses as a part of human physiology here. Why are our noses where they are and what they are? We have this sort of triangular thing. We have two nostrils, but we have two separate eyes. We have two separate ears. Why wouldn't we have another nose somewhere?
Well, our nose is actually divided into two separate chambers.
but more or less in the same spot. Yeah. Why? Okay. So, but address that. Why do you have two separate chambers? Why not just one?
Well, actually, our noses go through a pattern of vasoconstriction and vasodilation from one side to the other. So for part of our breathing cycle, and Kevin may know the exact duration here, Nathan jump in as well, I think it's on the order of something like 45 minutes to an hour, we may actually be breathing predominantly through one side of our nose versus the other. And then we shift from side to side because it allows, in a way, the tissue to sort of regenerate its capacity mm-hmm. because if it's constantly going through, it'll become too desiccated and too dried out. This really becomes apparent to us if we have an infection, if we have some kind of cold where one side of our nose is blocked up.
Yes.
Because when we go to that side that we're trying to breathe through on the other side, it becomes extremely difficult to do.
Mm. Any thoughts on that, Kevin, the design of the nose?
Other than the points Bob made, which I think are right on target, just the design aspect of having an opening that leads to the trachea, to the lungs, the most efficient direct pathway, certainly.
Do any of you identify any possible flaws in the design of our noses, generally speaking? Would ever thought in a private moment, you know, it would be a little bit better if the nose had this design. A little bit different. Nathan?
Well, you know, we've done some work on the growth of the nasal septum, the actual structure in the midline of the nose that divides those into two separate chambers. And what we found is that, you know, in humans, we have a high incidence of septal deviation, which means that in some individuals, it just becomes very hard to breathe through the nose.
Deviation, for instance, if you're hit or something is broken there?
Well, not necessarily. Just during growth, the nasal septum overgrows the rest of the nose. And as a result, it can produce blockage in one side of the nose or the other. Mm-hmm. And in some instances, what happens is that it becomes so severe that people have to bypass that system altogether and spend more time breathing through their mouth as opposed to their nose. And so that heating and humidification of the airstream is actually – the ability to do so is reduced as a result of that septal deviation. And that's something that's not wholly unique to humans, but certainly occurs in a much higher frequency in humans than it does in other animals.
Mm-hmm. Nathan Holton, you've authored this, lead author in this study, finding human male noses 10% larger than human female noses in populations of European descent. What implications does this have, or where do you want to take this? Where does this lead you in terms of further questions or implications?
Well, our primary reason for doing this study was try to understand, you know, why we see a reduction in nasal size in modern humans compared to archaic humans like Neanderthals. We know that there's a significant reduction in the size of the nose that's associated with a significant reduction in the size of the face. But we also know that when we compare modern humans to Neanderthals, modern humans also have lower body mass, are estimated to have required less energy, less oxygen. So we wanted to determine and see to what degree might that reduction in body mass in human evolution actually drive a reduction in nasal size. So that was a primary goal. Those are kind of hard to do in fossils, so we looked to differences in males and females, where we also find differences in energetics and oxygen consumption, those sorts of things.
We're running out of time this hour as we talk about our ability to adapt to different temperatures, focusing the last few minutes on our noses. But I wanted to get back to Kevin Craigle as we talked about adapting to the cold weather as we enter the coldest months of the season. Do you run into myths about our adaptability to cold or how we deal with the cold, Kevin Craigle?
Oh, certainly. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that's never been supported by the scientific. But one example we've been talking about off air was the idea of alcohol and its ability to generate warmth, the sensation of warmth. And interestingly, it's really quite counterproductive and can generate hypothermia rather quickly. And what I mentioned earlier is typically when we're exposed to cold, we vasoconstrict the skin region. So we create this insulated shell. Well, alcohol tends to cause vasodilation of the skin. That's why you see flushing of the cheeks and a red nose.
That's why we feel warmer.
Right. You feel warmer because you're perfusing the skin with that warm blood. So the payoff there is that we're able to have that sensation of warmth, but we're losing heat from the body core. So clearly alcohol can contribute to hypothermia.
Many of us are parents, parents of whatever age children. How does adaptability to cold pertain to children? Of course, the cliche thing was the case with my children, running outdoors, even in these temperatures, with just a shirt on, perhaps not even a cap or gloves. How much do we need to worry about that? If a child says, I am not cold out here, do we need to worry?
Well, you hit the nail on the head in terms of describing it as running outside. When they're metabolically active, they're typically able to maintain core body temperature, generate internal heat. But children are certainly more susceptible to hypothermia than adults. They have, as we this thread we've talked about, the surface area to mass. Children have a very large surface area to mass ratio. They can dissipate heat much more quickly. So if they're inactive or not having the appropriate kind of clothing, their body core temperature can go down rather quickly.
Mm-hmm. Are we bothered more by the cold as we get older, though?
With aging, yes. We have reduced ability, for example, to vasoconstrict the skin. So again, another opportunity to dissipate more heat, and certainly with aging in general, less sensation of cold. So the behavioral responses that younger individuals may take, the steps they would take, may not be present in older individuals to the same extent.
Mm-hmm. What about the age-old question of how much being cold has to do with you getting sick or getting a cold?
There is a clear correlation between cold weather, cold exposure, and getting sick. Influenzas, pneumonias.
Is that simply because we tend to stay indoors, or does actually the temperature drop do something?
There is some link physiologically with changes, for example, in the immune system and indoors and exchange of germs. So all of those things are linked. There's not one causal factor in that situation.
We have certain people who love to take a dip in water, even when it's of extremely low temperature, just above freezing. Polar bear clubs all around the world. What's going on there? People enjoying to take a dip in icy waters. All of the science would seem to say that's something that we're programmed to avoid, and yet a certain number of people seek it out, delight in it, in fact.
Right. I think that it's probably more of a exhilaration effect. There's certainly not necessarily a beneficial adaptation to jumping in extremely cold water for a short period of time. If you were to do it repeatedly, certainly there may be some of these acclimatization effects that we had talked about earlier in the show. Those could be
– So repeatedly getting into cold water attunes your body to it.
Certainly. That mm-hmm. would be the case. Uh-huh.
What is happening in the body when I jump in 40 or 35 degree water?
Well, you're certainly initiating a really rapid vasoconstrictor response in the skin. Your thermoreceptor skin are sending signals, I need to reduce blood flow. I need to insulate my body core.
Blood flow to all parts or reduce just to extremities?
Just to the extremities.
Arms, legs.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the whole skin surface in general, but especially arms and legs. We try to retain that heat in the core. At some point, you'll likely start shivering. There are other metabolic effects to try to generate heat. There are situations where at points you may start dilating the digits again to try to maintain function. So periodically, we actually increase flow to the fingers and toes to help maintain function.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned exhilaration. What is the cause of the exhilaration? Something being let loose in the brain?
Presumably, yes.
There's some unanswered questions.
I've not encountered that situation, so I can't speak from experience.
Is it Chol or Choi on our Twitter would like to know why someone's nose would sweat in the winter? Does anybody have a thought on that?
I'm Bob? Not sure. There's a distinction I'm not sure if she's referring to sweating per se on the surface skin of the nose versus just the idea of a runny nose. I mean, the idea of a runny nose makes a lot of sense simply because of the dynamics that I talked about earlier. You're saving a lot more moisture. that moisture oftentimes just dribbles out of the nose. That's a secondary
response. So if we're out skiing or snowshoeing and things like that, you have a runny nose.
Right.
That's just due to the condensation?
That's right. And it's something that's happening all the time, but just under those kinds of ambient conditions, it's amplified. If I could mention something that add on to what Kevin said a little earlier, one of the interesting adaptations to people living in circumpolar Arctic regions is the notion of layered clothing. Because if they're working, if they're engaged in a lot of activity that's going to produce high levels of body heat, they need to take those clothes off slowly to keep from sweating profusely. Because if you start sweating too much in cold environments, it's very bad.
Okay. Bob Franciscus, fascinating conversation, professor in the Department of Anthropology at the UI. Nathan Holton, thank you for joining us, assistant professor in the University of Iowa College of Dentistry. And Kevin Craigle from the Department of Health and Human Physiology at the University of Iowa. Fascinating discussion. Thank you all for coming into our studio to talk about adapting to the coldest months of the season. We appreciate it, gentlemen. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on this program, an update on the Affordable Care Act. We'll find out where we are in that and answer your questions. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.